Morning. Welcome here. Don't know if you expected this, but shockingly enough, we're in Genesis today. I know I'm not funny. I just try. There. I think I'm all set up. With no further delay and ado. Let's start with the word of the Lord. Let's start with prayer, and we can see what God has to say in His word today. Bow with me, please. Dear Lord, as we come before you, we thank you so much for your word. We thank you for the opportunity that we can open it, that we can seek to understand it, that we can learn from it, that we can recognize our need, that we can change accordingly, that we have this time to learn both who you are and what you expect from us. And so as we once again open your word, I pray that you would give us the ears to hear what you're saying. I pray that you would give us hearts soft enough to apply what we hear. And I pray above all that you would work. We all recognize that this is not of our own ability, our own strength, our own work. We simply seek to be diligent and to strive in the power that you give us, in the faith that you give us, in the everything that you give us. Moment by moment, day by day, we're given the breath, the ability, the mental faculties to even interact with your word. And so I pray that as we truly recognize that we are weak, that our every moment is only held up by your sustaining strength, I pray that you sustain us in this effort, that you grant us the faith to believe, and that you would affect that faith and have it bear fruit, that we could truly walk what we learn here today. Pray this in your holy name, Lord. Amen. So if you were here for Sunday school, Chris did an excellent job of introing my sermon. I don't know if he knew that, but that is what he did. What is the purpose of our life? And again, most of us think of that catechism verse, right? To glorify God and to enjoy Him forever. So I don't imagine it's surprising for most of us when I say that we are created solely for the pleasure of God. We are His creation. We are created for the purpose that He put within us, meaning that as His creation, our very purpose is the glory of God and our pursuing His purposes with all of our ability and energy, seeking to live lives that make Him pleased with us, right? We all want to hear, well done, good and faithful servant, enter into the joy of your Lord, right? That's our driving goal, let alone the fact that He sent His Son to give His life in order to purchase us from our debt of sin and the wrath we had accrued against ourselves and our slavery to sin. The point being that God is above all, worthy of all, and in fact the source and owner of all. He is the King. And so our lives are meant to be lived for His good pleasure. But is that the case? How often do we find our lives or find ourselves living our lives or doing something that we really can't cut either way, that we didn't do that for the glory of God, we did that for ourselves? How often is that the measure of our lives? And it's our flesh, right? Constantly prodding and persuading us away from what we know to be true. The sin that remains within us, seeking to undermine the accomplished work of God in our lives. We know very well what God thinks of sin. We know very well what the consequences of sin are. And yet, more often than not, we are not near concerned enough about our holiness and look at our sin more like a minor issue. We are called to pay close attention to what we have heard because we do not want to be found neglecting our salvation. But is that the thrust of our effort? How often do we mourn over our sin? How often should we mourn over our sin? How often do we seek to think of sin like our God does? We have countless examples of the destructiveness of sin, but do we recognize them and then heed their warning? 1 Corinthians 10, verses 5 to 11 says, speaking of the, and this is speaking of the Israelites during their trek through the wilderness, Paul says there, "Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not well pleased, for they were struck down in the wilderness. Now these things happened as examples for us, so that we would not crave evil things as they also craved. Do not be idolaters as some of them were, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and stood up to play. Nor let us act in sexual immorality as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in one day. Nor let us put Christ to the test as some of them did and were destroyed by the serpents. Nor grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now these things happened to them as an example, and they were written for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the ages have arrived." The very reason we're given the Old Testament is as an example of the consequences of sin, of what happens when we are ruled by our desires, when we let the flesh demand the direction of our lives as opposed to God. They were given us as an example, written for our instruction, not so that we could see what they got away with and we could test to see if we could get away with the same, but that we could see the consequences of their lives and seek instead to live lives in contrast to them, keeping our focus off of ourselves and our pleasure, and instead of turning our focus to God and His good pleasure. We often don't understand what to do with the bad things in our lives, or what we categorize as bad. How to think of them, how to pray about them or through them, how to live through them to the glory of God. But I think our text makes it abundantly clear today that everything God does is for a purpose, even judgment. And we've seen that overall already coming up, but we see it so specifically here, that even the calamities that may befall us are for a purpose, that testify to who God is and what He is about. We will see in our text 3 points that show the intention of judgment on this side of death is as an example, and is meant to teach all those who may see or witness that sin, the effect of that sin, what the consistent reality of all sin is, and that one day all sin will be judged. I think of that passage in Romans 8 and 9, right? Vessels of wrath and vessels of mercy. It may be hard for us to think about God delaying long or having much patience over these vessels of wrath, but He is still preparing them to be a visible example of His mercy upon the elect, right? There is an intentional example that God is playing out with every person. There is a fullness of time for all things, and one day God will mete out justice upon all mankind, returning everything to its pristine condition as it was intended. Last time we were in Genesis, we saw the flood arrive, the fountains of the deep and the floodgates of heaven opened up, and it rained like never before and like it never would again. And for 40 days and 40 nights, it poured forth God's judgment upon a world mired in sin. And that's where we find ourselves today, at the tail end of that. Which brings us to our first point, found in Genesis chapter 8 and verses 1 to 9. So let's read those 9 verses. "Then God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the cattle that were with him in the ark, and God caused a wind to pass over the earth, and the water subsided. Also the fountains of the deep and the floodgates of the sky were closed, and the rain from the sky was restrained, and the water receded from the earth, going forth and returning, and at the end of 150 days the water decreased. In the 7th month, on the 17th day of the month, the ark rested upon the mountains of Ararat. Now the water decreased steadily until the 10th month. In the 10th month, on the 1st day of the month, the tops of the mountains appeared. And then it happened at the end of 40 days that Noah opened the window of the ark which he had made, and he sent out a raven. And it went out flying back and forth until the water was dried up from the earth. Then he sent out a dove from him to see if the water was abated from the face of the land. But the dove found no resting place for the sole of its foot. So it returned him into the ark, for the water was on the surface of all the earth. Then he stretched out his hand and took it and brought it into the ark to himself." I titled this point, Judgment Accomplished. Because in this event, we see an example of what the judgment of God against sin looks like when it is complete. Remembering that the Israelites are hearing about their God and coming to understand what their God thinks of sin, they now come to understand the scope of God's rule. Living during that time and among those people, it would have been easy for them to see God as something of a tribal deity. Sure, he claims to be all-powerful. Sure, he claims to be able to do all kinds of things, but we've seen every nation claim to have gods that control everything. Something that just, maybe this God somehow just applied to them, or that the truths that God spoke of were local, that God was a God like the gods of Egypt. Now, God has already proven that he is greater than the gods of Egypt through the plague, so at least that's a win. But now through the telling of Genesis, God has been showing his people that he is the only God, the one true God, and all other gods are no gods at all. It's something similar that we're seeing here in regards to the judgment of God. Can one God truly have the authority and the power to judge the whole world? And we actually see that still being a problem for people to grasp. One of the biggest arguments against the flood is whether or not it was a local flood or a whole worldwide flood. And mainly for the same reason, people struggle to admit that God is as powerful as he claims to be. How can one God be over so many different people groups? How can one God dictate the lives of so many people? How can one God stand in judgment over them? Is that not presumptuous? It all stems from a wrong view of ourselves. We can't fathom that there is someone just better than us who has rightly the authority over our lives and over every life. But in fact, God does have that authority, and because of that, all will stand before him in judgment one day. So we remember back to Genesis chapter 6, verse 5. If you don't remember, you're welcome to just glance back. That God saw that man was evil. Yahweh saw the evil of man was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And Yahweh regretted that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. And Yahweh said, I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the land, from man to animals to creeping things and to the birds of the sky, for I regret that I have made them. And God, seeing the depths to which man had sunk, decides to make an example of them and start again with Noah by flooding the earth. God shows the extent of his power over the whole world. But even more central is the point for which God is pouring out this judgment. It is so that future generations will know what God thinks of sin. Till now, we've seen the fall, we've seen the result of the fall, we've seen humanity striving in their own ability, and these rare few people who walk with God, who seek after God, who are considered righteous, but they are a rare remnant that we see follow through. But we haven't seen God make a declarative statement to show something of what he thinks of sin. That's what the flood is. Because of the flood, all will understand both the severity of the sin and the consequence thereof, that God will not be mocked, and nothing can be hidden from God, and that one day justice will be found for every situation. And so God floods the world with what in our mind has to be only an extreme display of power, but for God, what is a measure of power when all power is yours? And so in this display, God removes the unrighteousness of man from his creation. But as always, God doesn't leave it there, because he is not only a God of wrath and justice, he is a God of mercy. And instead of eradicating all of humanity and going back to how it was before with just the Trinity, he makes a way for Noah and his family to survive. And I've heard this quote, and I couldn't find who said it, but it's something like, true power is not just being able to destroy, but true power is being able to destroy and deciding not to. Now, I have no comment as to what true power is, other than it is embodied in God. However, God is this way, ever capable of eradicating anyone who steps out of line, but ever leaving and giving time for mercy. He has all power and still decides to be merciful, though he is able to at any point withdraw his sustaining power and end all mankind in the blink of an eye. He continues with his plan that through the gospel of his Son, mankind has the freedom to find, or has the opportunity to find freedom from their sin, that they have the opportunity to return to a righteous standing with him. Here we see a reflection of that mercy. The flood has covered the earth, even the tallest mountains, and then God remembered Noah. Throughout the Old Testament, there is a significance to calling God to remember. That in the midst of trial and terrible circumstance, the Israelites would call on God and ask him to remember them. Remember your people. Remember that you are our God. To remember his promises to them, and they would once again offer their obedience to live as his people. Such is the mercy of God that he would hear even these prayers after a people who have left him constantly. And he would remember them. He would hear them. Jeremiah 15:15 says, here's where Jeremiah himself pleads for vengeance. And he says, "You who know, O Yahweh, remember me. Take notice of me. Take vengeance for me on my persecutors. Do not, in view of your patience, take me away. Know that for your sake I endure reproach." Right? We see this kind of a call for God to remember him, to take notice of him, right? It's to have mercy on him is almost what the call is. We see the same thing in Habakkuk 3 verse 2. "O Yahweh, I have heard the report about you and I fear. O Yahweh, revive your work in the midst of the years. In the midst of the years, make it known. In rage, remember compassion." Habakkuk understands the position of God, his fury against unrighteousness, and he calls for God to remember compassion. In the midst of your rage, remember compassion. That's the kind of idea of when God remembers his people. He remembers that they are his. He remembers their forefathers. He remembers that he loves them and that they are but dust. He remembers their infirmities, their weaknesses, and he has compassion. That's what God is here for Noah. In the midst of his dealing out the deserved justice upon the world and their sin, he remembers Noah and all the beasts and all the cattle that are in the ark, and he causes the flood to subside. He causes his judgment to pull back, and a wind passes over the earth, and the water subsides. The fountains of the deep and the floodgates of the sky are closed, and the water recedes. After 150 days, the water starts to decrease. Part of the reality of this narrative is shown in the recording of these days. And that how long these things took are all recorded as an actual measure in history. And finally, after a long time, the ark finally rests on the mountains of Ararat. I don't know if you're anything like me, but I was a lot older than I should have been when I realized this wasn't a singular mountain, but a mountain range. I'm like, I don't know why people struggle so hard to find this Noah's ark or where it rested, right? It's a singular mountain. Go find it. But it's more than that. So, anyways, not important. What's actually important is that this word for rested, that the ark rested on the mountains of Ararat, is the same word or version of the same word used for Noah's name. Now, again, I don't want to pull out too much symbolic meaning or stuff, but there is a flow that we see here. If you remember back or want to flip back to Genesis chapter 5, verse 28, you'll see the recording of Noah's birth. And you might recall, what do we see happens different, right? Remember, chapter 5 was the whole genealogy of how long people lived and a son they had, and they had many other sons and daughters. And finally, we got to Lamech. And Lamech lived 182 years and became the father of a son. Now, he called his name Noah, saying, "This one will give us rest from our work and from the pain of our hands arising from the ground, which Yahweh has cursed." Thinking through the story of Noah and what you know of it, how does Noah ever give rest to people from the curse? Noah, for 120 years, while building the ark, was a preacher of righteousness. That's what it tells us in 2 Peter 2, verse 5. Proclaiming the way of true rest found only in God. And as is shown by his own example, Noah lived a life of rest even in the midst of the storm of God's judgment. As the world perished around him, Noah was safe and secure in the ark that God had commanded him to build, held safely in the hands of God. Noah kept finding rest in God. As judgment rained down on all creation, Noah waited on God. As the ark rests down on the mountain and the water continues to decrease steadily, we see the rest that God continues to provide for those that trust in him, who follow his commands. They are the ones that God remembers. To them, God extends his mercies. Noah did end up changing things. Noah did end up bringing rest to the people of God, but surely not in any way that his father would have considered. Then it happens that Noah opens the window in the ark and starts sending out birds to see the condition of the land. First, he sends out a raven, and now we're not given much of a reason why. It makes sense that it's likely because it was an unclean bird, one that was neither good for food or for sacrifice. It was an expendable bird. And being a stronger bird, able to live off of the carrion that would have still been available, it never returns. And it keeps flying around until the water is dried up from the earth. Noah then sends out a dove, and the dove finds no resting place, so it comes back to the ark. And our text says something that seems to confirm to Noah the reality of God and his purview over all the earth. Verse 9, the second half, it says there, "So it returned to him into the ark, for the water was on the surface of all the earth." It almost seems like Noah recognizes the extent of God's judgment with this moment of confirmation. He understands that he's in a flood. He understands it's an intense flood. But even just comprehending the idea that the whole world is covered in water must have been something just to consider. And then he sends out this bird, and it can find nothing. Now remember, they're on a mountain, meaning this flood extends further even than they can imagine, right? It in fact covers the whole world. And it seems like Noah here recognizes the completeness of God's judgment, that all that God promised back in chapter 6 when he commanded Noah to build the ark has truly come to pass, and the unrighteous have been wiped from the earth. All in whom was the breath of life have perished. That not only does God have the right to judge the world, he has the might. This flood, this judgment accomplished the impossible and set an undeniable example of what God thinks of sin and what God can and will do about sin. Keeping in mind that this is all being told to the Israelites as they're being informed who their God is, there must have been something of a shocked silence. The whole world has died, except for 8 people. Everyone else has paid the price for their sin and their rebellion against God. And now here are they, this little tribe of people. Though large in number, they are still nothing compared to all the nations. And even they haven't been living according to the will and the command of God. They didn't know them, but the whole world isn't living according to the will of God. And such is this God's greatness that not only is he worthy, he is due the worship of all mankind. He has every right to judge them and to judge the whole world again with a flood. So what stands in the way of God once again cleansing the world and starting fresh? Seems like it would be far more convenient than even bothering to save them from slavery. Why would a God this powerful do any of that? And I think the example flows through all the way to us as we live in this blessed time where we know the outcome of these historical events. We understand what they're pointing to, and we even understand where God is going with these plans. We are still very prone to forget what God thinks of sin. What God will do with sin. We sit here retelling the story of Noah, easily forgetting why this whole event occurred. How much God hates sin. Sure, we know that he won't do it again with a flood, but God will not, God cannot abide sin. And one day, this sort of thing will happen again, that the judgment of God will flow forth upon the world, and all those opposed to God, all those who refuse to believe in Christ for the salvation of their souls, will pay for their own sin. They will die, and then they will face judgment, and they will pay eternally for their sins against God. It is only those who rest in God, in his promised, in this case, and in our case, provided Messiah, that will find rest and reprieve in the mercy of God, having their sins paid for in the Son. I think the lesson of the flood still should weigh upon us greatly as we seek to remember who all sin is against first and foremost, and what the ultimate cost of that sin was. Which brings us then to our second point, found in verses 10 to 19. Where it says, then he waited yet another 7 days, and again he sent out the dove from the ark. And the dove came to him toward evening, and behold, in its beak was a freshly picked olive leaf. So Noah knew the water was abated from the earth, and then he waited yet another 7 days and sent out the dove. But it did not return to him again. Now it happened in the 601st year, in the first month, on the first of the month, the water was dried up from the earth. Then Noah removed the covering of the ark and looked, and behold, the surface of the ground was dried up. In the second month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth was dry. Then God spoke to Noah, saying, go out of the ark, you and your wife and your sons' wives with you, bringing out with you every living thing of all flesh that is with you, birds and animals, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, that they may swarm on the earth, and that they may be fruitful and multiply on the earth. So Noah went out, and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him. Every beast and every creeping thing, and every bird and everything that moves on the earth went out by their families from the ark. And I titled this point, Judgment Abated, because we see the continued mercy, the removal of God's judgment from the world. It's here that we see the result of God's judgment upon the world, right? Abated means to remove, to recede. Noah has now confirmed that the flood was complete, and so he waits another 7 days and sends out the dove again. And when it returns in its beak, it's holding a freshly picked olive leaf. And then Noah knows that the judgment of God won't last forever. Our passage says that Noah knew that the water was abated from the earth. Remember, Noah's been in this boat for a long time. First the 40 days of rain, then the 150 days of floating around, and then another 7 months and change before sending out the birds. And now it's been another week of them being in this boat, taking care of these animals. I think it's hard for us to consider how long it truly would be just to live in this boat. Imagine the worst of winters where you can't leave your yard and still you have more space and freedom than Noah ever did. This is all in the space of that single ark. When that dove returned with the olive leaf, there must have been substantial relief that one day this too would pass. One day their time in the ark would be over. Such relief that even this time of complete pouring out of God's wrath against sinners would end, and once again they would be able to live in the glory of God's favor as he remembers them and turns his face towards them in blessing. Noah waits another 7 days and he sends out the dove again, and this time it doesn't return. Rather, it finds a place to nest. And Noah finally has proof that the earth is dry enough for things to grow. And so Noah removes the covering of the ark and sees that the ground is indeed dry. Then God speaks to Noah and commands them to go out of the ark and to bring the animals out with them. And Noah to do this, and he tells them to do this for a purpose. Look at verse 17. Bring out with you every living thing of all the flesh that is with you, birds and animals and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, that they may swarm on the earth and that they may be fruitful and multiply on the earth. Now that sounds familiar, right? It's only a couple of chapters ago where we see this blessing given to Adam. And so we see here a renewing of that original blessing given out by God, which in turn becomes a responsibility or even a duty. This will be more clear when we get to chapter 9, where it's reinforced and applied to Noah. But we already see that connection here. Remembering Genesis 1:22, then God blessed them, saying, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters in the sea, and the birds multiply on the earth." As well as verse 28, God blesses them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the sky, and over every living thing that creeps on the earth." Right? It's a reconnection, calling us back to, it's a re-giving of that original command and covenant of God's intention for his people. With evil and sin removed from the world, at least as far as those living in opposition to God, Noah and his family were considered righteous by God. They now find themselves in turn realigned to their original purpose, to be fruitful and to multiply, to fill the earth, to have dominion over it and to subdue it. Granted, in Noah's case, like I said, it's a less specific command. It's just here for the animals. It's in chapter 9 where we'll see it applied to him. But the connection's already there. We're already supposed to remember Genesis 1. We're already supposed to realize that Noah and his family are starting again, that God has implemented a new creation event with these eight people. He's showing the return to the original command. Evil is removed, righteousness has been given its place. Once again, even though humanity has squandered the mercy of God, and even though they have failed in their created purpose in taking over dominion of the world for the glory of God, God has handed out judgment due upon the world and returned the world to an Edenic state. And now God hands out the same mercy he did back then. He gives Noah the same provision that Adam had and the same command to go out to multiply as well as to bring out the animals so that they can multiply over the whole earth. God is allowing his creation to once again take part in the blessing and alongside the blessing to take part in the responsibility and the duty of this world. I think it's important for us to realize how connected that is. That the blessing of God is in turn a responsibility. As Adam was blessed with the mandate to go forth and multiply, it was an inherent responsibility that they would do so. So it is with Noah, who has been blessed to go out in all the world. It is a responsibility in that they are not supposed to stay in one group in one place, but to go out and fill the earth. What truly sums up the incredible nature of what God is doing here, though, is that he is giving humanity a second chance. As Adam was the figurative head of humanity, and through him sin came into the world, it's through Noah that we have a second chance to try again to develop a society that follows the will of God and lives in obedience to God, reaping the promised reward that comes from the blessing of God. Not only did God have mercy on Noah in letting his judgment recede from the world and giving him an opportunity to begin again in this new world, God extended this mercy to Noah in that he gave him the opportunity to try again with a new society, started with his sons, to lead them in the way of righteousness, following the commands of God and living lives that reflected the grace and mercy of God upon them. Having this visceral example of the flood that they've lived through, having this understanding that is tangible to them of how bad sin is and what God thinks of sin and how sin corrupts, having seen all the generations before them seem to follow after the way of man, seeking to strengthen themselves in their own ability, Noah and his family have had a direct example of what God will do with sin. And now they're given this opportunity to live in light of that, to go forth and act according to what they know. It was all a merciful act of God, again and again showing his long-suffering nature. God has mercy on humanity and gives him another chance to live out their created purpose and to follow the commands that he has given them. And again, trying to think of how the Israelites would have seen this, having themselves been brought through a water experience, right? As Moses parted the Red Sea and then having it close over the Egyptians in judgment, the Israelites must have felt like God was starting again with them. a nation of slaves without a home, without anything of their own to bring to the table, a rather pitiful nation, and yet God has deemed it a good thing to start with them, promised to bring them to the promised land, promised to give them a home and to make them into something great if only they follow him, obey him, if only they do as he has commanded them. Though they may have felt like they were under the curse of God as slaves in Egypt, they have found themselves being cared for and provided for by God, being protected and built up by God, having supernatural responses to their situation as they trek through this wilderness. They must have felt the responsibility that comes with such a blessing as they look to the future and they consider this narrative. We've been given all of this. We've been sustained visibly and completely by God through this desert. No other nation could have survived without this God. What does he expect of us tomorrow? Why did he bring us through? What does it mean now that we know him and we understand the responsibility the whole world has in light of him? What does that require of us in turn? There must have been some of this starting to percolate. And I think the same follows for us as we recognize the mercy of God extended to all humanity, especially. We can look back in the Old Testament again and again and again and again and see a merciful God, no doubt. But we again are in an extreme position of mercy, understanding the mercy that's been extended in the gospel call. As we see God be merciful to sinners, letting them live as they continue in their lives of rebellion against God. As we see them take the very rainbow that God will hang up in the next chapter and use it as a sign to promote sin, to legitimize a life in opposition to the very command of God, the God that made them, they'll be shocked when they finally recognize what that rainbow is. To use that to legitimize sin, is there anything that snubs God more? We know that there is enough sin in the world that apart from his promise, God would have every right to once again flood the earth in righteous judgment. And there was none who could hold that against him. But we know he won't. Because he is who he is and he is nothing if not faithful to his word. But we can clearly see how God would say that man is evil, that the thoughts of man's heart is only evil continually. We can see that in ourselves, as recipients of God's grace, we still struggle with our love for sin and our pursuit of worldliness. What are we but depraved? But such is the grace of God that he enables us to pursue godliness. He enables us in our fight against sin. He enables us to be his ambassadors and to participate in his work and his plan for the world. As Jesus asked his disciples in Luke 12, verses 42 to 48, "Who then is the faithful and prudent steward whom his master will put in charge of his servant to give them their rations at the proper time? Blessed is that slave whom his master finds so doing when he comes. Truly I say to you that he will put him in charge of all his possessions. But if that slave says in his heart, 'My master will be long in coming,' and begins to beat the male and female servants and to eat and drink and to get drunk, the master of that slave will come on a day when he does not expect and an hour he does not know and will cut him in pieces and assign him a place with the unbelievers. And the slave who knew his master's will and did not get ready or act in accord with his will receive many beatings. But the one who did not know and committed deeds worthy of a beating will receive but a few. From everyone who has been given much, much will be required. But to whom they entrusted much, of him they will ask all the more." As we are blessed, as we are given more and more in regards to the life of godliness, more is required of us. The servant who was given 10 talents was expected to return on 10 talents. Not the same as the one with 5 or the one with 1. Same for the one who was given less. Less was expected. But the reality is that as they were blessed more, they had more responsibility, more expectation from God to steward those blessings and to return on them. The same is true with us. As we are blessed, we are expected to use that blessing. If you think of your life right now and the access and the availability you have to the Word of God, to teaching on the Word of God, to considerations of the Word of God, to understanding the Word of God, just the average person, what you have available to you. What are we going to be held accountable for when God comes and we say we didn't know? How could you not? There is a striving in this life. There is an expectation, a responsibility that comes with blessing. And I don't think any of us would argue that we are blessed by God. And there is a responsibility inherent in that, just like it was with Noah. Noah was blessed with the favor of God and being given a way to weather the judgment of God. Noah was blessed with the mercy of God as his judgment receded from the world. And Noah was blessed with the responsibility that was originally given to Adam to be fruitful and to multiply over the earth. God gave them the example of his judgment against sin. And the result was that Noah was now to take that mercy of God extended to him and to fulfill the responsibility of the blessing and the favor of God. To live out the mandate in that blessing to be fruitful and to multiply and to be followers of God. And Noah has every intention to do just that. Look at our last section of verses where we find our third point in verse 20. Then Noah built an altar to Yahweh and took every clean animal and of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. And Yahweh smelled the soothing aroma, and Yahweh said to himself, I will never again curse the ground because of man, for the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth, and I will never again strike down every living thing as I have done. While all the days of the earth remain, seed time and harvest and cold and heat and summer and winter and day and night shall not cease. Title this last point, Judgment Altered, because though nothing has actually changed with humanity, God promises to never do this again. Noah gets off the ark and what seems like almost immediately builds an altar and takes one of every clean animal and one of every clean bird and offers them as a burnt offering on the altar. Seemingly, Noah has taken the illustration of the wrath of God to heart. He recognizes who God is and wants to worship him as is his due. God smells the soothing aroma of these sacrifices, and not because barbecue smells good, but the atonement, the covering of their blood, offers recompense as Noah worships as is prescribed and offers up these animals. God is pleased at the obedient worship. And then we see the significant portion of our text, verse 21. And Yahweh smelled the soothing aroma, and Yahweh said to himself, I will never again curse the ground because of man, for the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth, and I will never again strike down every living thing as I have done. Noah has seen the sin of man, understands the depth of the depravity of man's heart. Having preached righteousness to a lost world for 120 years, Noah knows how resistant they are to God. I think it's Isaiah who gets the call to go and preach to a people who will not listen, to go and speak to a people who will not hear. And how long? And he says, until there's nobody left. Right? Like, that's kind of what Noah did. Like, 120 years, and there's still only the eight of them. And now having seen what God thinks of that sin, what the judgment of God is against sin, and the extent of God's power to judge the whole world, Noah has seen the example, and Noah recognizes in himself that he is the one carrying the result of God's plan to continue on, that the call is now on him to live righteously. It's one thing to be seen as righteous. It's another thing to continue in righteousness. And so Noah recognizes the result of the judgment of God, that God has been merciful. And the grace is now to extend it to him is in itself a responsibility to go forth and to continue in that obedience, fulfilling the blessed mandate that is put upon him after the glory of God. And now we see the lesson. God knows that nothing has changed. Man is still evil in their hearts. Like it said in chapter 6, verse 5, then Yahweh saw that the evil of man was great on the earth and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. This hasn't changed. Look at what it says in verse 21. For the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth.
There's no delineation as if this was before a before the flood condition. No, this is still the case. Man's heart is still evil from his youth. But such is the love and the compassion of God that the depth of evil of mankind won't dictate the judgment he hands out. But rather, God alters the parameters of his judgment. Mankind now knows what God thinks of sin. Mankind understands what the cost of sin is. Mankind has no excuse when they are judged because of their sin, because the example has been set. God flooded the world because of sin, but God was also merciful. He drew back the flood and let mankind try again. Through Noah, he started rebuilding humanity with a new opportunity to follow after him. The result of the example is an obligation towards righteousness. We know the consequences of one kind of action. It is our responsibility to then follow the wisdom of what is right. And therein lies the lesson. God doesn't keep punishing sin with a flood, but rather now mankind awaits a final judgment where God will finally judge each and every person according to their works. And there will be no partiality, no variation of judgment, because all now know the cost of sin. And so now the result of that example is being shown to us in our call to live righteously. We live like we understand the example we were shown. We live as if we have learned the lesson that God placed before us. We seek to think of sin like God does. We strive after the holiness that he has called us unto. This is how God works. He doesn't need to repeat himself. He gives an example, and then we are called to remember that example, because one day we will be held to that standard. And I think there's another one that kind of pops to our mind that is often used and understood, and it's the example of Ananias and Sapphira. I'm going to read it to you, and I just kind of want you to listen closely as we think of what God is doing here. What was the purpose of their example? A man named Ananias with his wife Sapphira sold a piece of property and kept back some of the price for himself with his wife's full knowledge, and bringing a portion of it, he laid it at the apostles' feet. And Peter said, Ananias, why has Satan filled your heart to lie to the Holy Spirit and to keep back some of the price of the land? While it remained unsold, did it not remain your own? And after it was sold, was it not under your authority? Why is it that you laid this deed in your heart? You have not lied to men, but to God. And as he heard these words, Ananias fell down and breathed his last. And great fear came over all who heard. And the young men rose up, wrapped him up, and after carrying him out, they buried him. Now there was an interval of about 3 hours, and his wife came in, not knowing what had happened. And Peter responded to her, tell me whether you were paid this much for the land. And she said, yes, that much. Then Peter said to her, why is it that you have agreed together to put the Spirit of the Lord to the test? Behold, the feet of those who buried your husband are at the door, and they will carry you out as well. And immediately she fell at his feet and breathed her last. And the young men came in, found her dead, and they carried her out and buried her beside her husband. And great fear came over the whole church and over all who heard these things. Did you catch that? Every time somebody lies, do we still see them fall over dead? Every time somebody lies to the leaders of their church, do they fall over dead? Of course not. So what was unique about this time? It was the fact that Ananias and Sapphira were an example. Because of their death, it says that great fear fell upon the church. Great fear of what? Great fear of God. As to who God is. As to how severely he looked at even the supposedly smaller of sins, right? I mean, it's a lie. People do that. Not in God's book, they don't. They see what the cost of sin was, and great fear fell upon the church. God doesn't now continue taking the life from everyone who lies. It's up to them to keep it in mind and to live accordingly, knowing the position of their God and the result of their actions, that if they don't heed this warning, God doesn't base his future judgment on the state of mankind as a whole. I'm sure we're measuring for the height of depravity of mankind, but that isn't the measuring mark. God has a set plan, and that is what's going to come about. That's why God says that while all the days of the earth remain, seed time and harvest and cold and heat and summer and winter and day and night shall not cease, because it's no longer based on a scale measuring the depravity of man, but instead it's based on the fullness of God's plan. When God decides that man has had their last opportunity, has committed their last act of rebellion, then God will return in judgment, and all humanity will recognize who is king. All doubt will be eradicated when he returns, and every knee will bow and every tongue will confess who is Lord. That's how the Israelites could have confidence that God wouldn't eradicate them now. That's how we can know that God won't suddenly get tired of us and start again with something new, because it isn't based on us, it's based on him. God has promised that he will accomplish what he has set out to do with all those who are his. God has declared clearly who he is and what he thinks of sin. He has even shown what he will do with sinners. He has given us every example, every description. He has given every reasoning. He has given every purpose as to how we're supposed to interact with sin and why we're supposed to do that. It's up to us to learn the lesson and to live accordingly, to believe him above our own flesh, our own understanding, our own examples, or our own comprehensions. In the end, it boils down to what do we do with what we know about God. We know we were created for the purpose of bringing him glory, in essence to bring God pleasure. Is that what we do? If not, why not? How do we expect that to end? Do we not believe that God will return in righteous judgment? And if we do believe that, can we see that faith working itself out in our lives? Are we acting like we believe that? We've spent our morning seeing a very literal example of God's judgment on sin, a flood that covered the whole earth, killing everyone but 8 people, likely billions of people, whom the remnant was only 8. That's the deceptiveness of sin. That's the corruption of sin, that only 8 people were considered righteous. Technically only 1, but his family was saved alongside him. If nothing else, I hope this passage has caused you to examine how you think of and how you deal with sin in your life, how you look at the flesh. Not that you're comparing yourselves to one another. You know, we're all not so bad. We're all kind of the same. I'm sure God grades on a curve. He loves us all, so it'll be fine. But comparing to what God says about sin, and so that every sin, so that the striving, the direction of our life is ever towards his standard, not one of our own making. I understand that none of us can be holy. None of us will be perfect on this side of heaven. But the call is that our eyes are ever set on Christ. Our eyes are ever set on what is truly holy, and that's what we're measuring ourselves after and reflecting ourselves according to. Because that's what God measures, our lives. And whether we lived our lives by faith in his Son, bearing the fruit of that faith in our obedience to his commands, showing the love of Christ that we claim to have as we claim to bear his name, or not. May that be the testimony of our lives. To kind of help us sum that all up in my final conclusion here, we've seen today the point of judgment that is an example for us, left for our instruction, meant to teach us the reality by which we structure our lives. We saw in our text the judgment accomplished in the example of the flood, that it was the whole world and all mankind paid for their sin. We saw what God thinks of sin all the way back then and still thinks of it, and how he still thinks of it today. And that this complete eradication is the cost of a life in rebellion against God. We saw the mercy of God in our second point as the judgment abated and God remembered Noah and ended the flood on the earth. We saw the result of that abatement was that Noah was now expected to go out and to live out the responsibility inherent in the blessing of God. That whatever God gifted Noah with was now an expectation upon him to bear the fruit of that blessing. Finally, we saw the judgment altered, where we saw the lesson left for us to grasp. That God no longer would judge humanity on the evil of their hearts as a whole, but rather judgment would wait until after they died, or for when the Lord would return and finally rule this creation himself. Which, of course, we don't know from our Genesis 8 study, but we know from our position here on this side of the New Testament. That instead humanity was now responsible to learn from this event and to live accordingly. They have seen what God thinks of sin. They've seen what God does with sin. May they fear him appropriately. I imagine Israel was growing quite clear on who this God was and the reverence and fear that was his due. We live on this side of abundant mercy. We've been so inundated our whole lives with messages of the love of God, of the grace of God, of the mercy of God. I'm not sure we truly understand what those things mean anymore. And so my prayer is that we learn this lesson well. May we remember what God thinks of sin and hate sin like he does. May we remember what it means to follow Christ, to live like he did, to live out the fruits of this new life he purchased for us by his death. And finally, may we never forget that God is not mocked. May we be genuine in our pursuit of God. May we live after the spirit of the law, looking to be a people of singular mind, loyally devoted to our God, loving God with our whole hearts, souls, minds, and strength, undivided, sincere, and wholly consumed in our pursuit of God as we see his will and hoping to see more of his will reflected in us. Bow with me in prayer. Dear Lord, as we look at Genesis 8, as we see the flood and the result thereof, as we try and wrap our head around only 8 people left on this whole world, as we try and think of how that would have been, what that would have been like to come out of that ark and to think what it meant that you eradicated everyone, what had led to that, but also to think of what that meant for you. How could your work be different? And then I think in a much smaller measure of our own lives, Lord, how do we, now realizing all the mercies and the abundant grace that we see in our lives, how do we now use that and utilize that so that it's not for nothing? So that it won't all get burnt up on that day when we face you. So that when we come before your throne in judgment, we will hear, "Well done, good and faithful servant, enter into the joy of your Lord." I think of even the idea how you have gifted us, you've given us abilities, you've given us certain strengths. You've given us opportunity, you've given us so much. And we are inherently from that blessing now responsible for it. So how do we steward that which you've given us? How do we be thankful and live our whole lives to your glory in all things? So I pray, Lord, that as we see this kind of an example from this story about the flood, that we would now go forth from here and live in light of that, that we would seek to live every moment to your glory. Truly living with our eyes upon you and your definition of holiness etched upon us as we go by day, trying to live out that law. Those commands, bearing the fruit, not because we're somehow earning our own holiness, but bearing the fruit that you've called of us. In your holy name, Lord, amen.